Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking about the event Celebrando las Acequias. I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Phil Carter. He is the Wildlife Campaign Manager with Animal Protection New Mexico, and we are here to talk about the practice of trapping, using steel traps to capture animals on public land. We're also joined by Maggie Craw, who is a concerned citizen who has some firsthand experience with traps on public land. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having me.
So to what extent is trapping, and what kind of trapping are we talking about, allowed on public land in New Mexico?
Well, the basic term for it is body grip trapping. These are traps that are set on the ground or sometimes underwater in order to crush the bodies of wildlife and anything that unlucky enough to step into them. There are three kinds of traps, the kind of typical steel jaw traps that people are most familiar with. That spring and clamp down on the leg of an animal. There are also
that look like horrible teeth.
Exactly. Sometimes they do have teeth. Sometimes they don't. But yeah, the kind of the popular imagination traps are those, the steel jaw traps. There are also snare traps that will actually ensnare animals, either their leg or their head, and another type called conibear traps that are often placed underwater and are designed to kind of grip and crush the whole body.
And so, in New Mexico, is that a common practice?
Yes, it is. It's legal on any public lands in New Mexico. That includes Forest Service land, BLM, and State Trust land, with a few exceptions. Los Alamos County and the Valle Vidal have banned traps. But any other public lands, trapping is legal.
Not public parks, obviously.
Not public parks, obviously, but any sort of, considered, forest land or any sort of wild land. Trapping is found on the public lands.
What kinds of animals are being trapped and for what reasons?
Well, to answer that, you have to understand that traps are designed to be indiscriminate. Basically, any animal with legs that touch the ground can trigger and get caught in a trap. Now, the two designations for wild animals of in New Mexico, as set by the New Mexico Game and Fish Department, are target animals. These are the animals that are quote unquote legal to trap.
For example, they
include like beavers, coyotes, foxes, raccoons, skunks. These animals are all legal to trap. And in fact, coyotes and skunks, certain types of skunks, are legal to trap all year round. You don't even need a permit. Now, traps also catch, because they are indiscriminate, any sort of animal with legs. That includes bears, deer, domestic dogs and cats, mountain lions, really anything can get caught in a trap.
Now, you, Maggie, actually have some personal experience with that. With your dog was caught in a trap.
Yeah, it was a very frightening experience. During mid-December, I was walking with her on Dome Road in the Santa Fe National Forest. This is a place where she and I frequently walk alone, but I was lucky on this day and that a friend and her dog were with us. As my friend and I were walking along, we suddenly heard loud, unrecognizable animal screams. It stopped us in our tracks trying to figure out what kind of animal it was. We didn't recognize it as anything we'd heard before. We were trying to figure out what was making the noise and which direction we should run from it when we realized that my dog Lulu was nowhere in sight.
Oh my goodness, so the sound you were hearing was your own dog?
Yeah. we thought, as soon as we saw that she was nowhere in sight, we realized that she was involved with it. At about that time, the sounds intensified, so it sounded like multiple animals engaged in a fight. My first thought was that she was in a fight with a mountain lion or a pack of wild coyotes or something like that. Obviously, our impulse was to run as quickly as we could away from the noise, but we had no choice once we realized that she was probably involved in it and run toward the noise. When we found her about 75 feet from the road, she was lying on the ground, and her foot was in a steel jaw leg hold trap. She was struggling like I've never seen an animal struggle in my life. It was it was just a horrendous experience.
Now, she's a big dog.
She's a big dog. She's a black lab that weighs 75 pounds. And as I said, her toes were caught in a trap, and the way she was struggling and pulling, it was a wonder that she didn't pull them off or break something.
It's also lucky that it didn't get another part of her body.
Yeah, her nose or some more sensitive part.
Yeah.
So we rushed over to her and started trying to release the trap, but she was struggling so hard, and there was so much tension on the trap that it wasn't possible. We had to physically force her towards the trap. My friend laid on top of her in order to release the tension so that I was then able to release the trap. As soon as we got her out, we looked at ourselves and realized that our clothing and our hands were covered with blood. My first impulse was that Lulu was injured and bleeding, and I examined her, and I didn't see any, she was limping, but I didn't see any blood anywhere, and that's when I saw the remains of a large, bloody chunk of meat that the bait had been trapped with, which I'm sure Phil will tell you is grossly illegal,
right?
To bait with anything, but certainly fresh, bloody meat.
So what happened then?
Well, she luckily she limped off. She looked okay, and she was lame for a couple of days. I looked at the trap. The trap had no identification on it. Again, it's mandatory that traps have some form of identification in the state of New Mexico. There was no identification on this trap at all. Lulu was mildly lame for a few days. Recovered.
She got lucky. I mean, these things can. I mean, you have experience, Phil, with this. They can crush an animal's leg completely. They can shatter its bone.
Right. I mean, it's ultimately lucky that Lulu was caught by her leg and not her snout, which there's been numerous cases of dogs getting their heads caught in traps and either
especially if they're baited like that,
and either suffocating or starving to death because nobody has checked on the trap in time.
She was also lucky in that I had a friend with me because she's a large dog and I'm a reasonably strong person, but without my friend to help me, I'm sure that I would not have been able to free her from that trap. I would have had to drive 45 minutes to get some help and leave her in the trap the whole time.
Oh, Lord. Yeah. Now, this kind of trapping is taking place in the same areas where people normally hike.
That's correct. And none of the land agencies, the Forest Service, BLM, or State Land Office, nor the New Mexico Department of Game and Fish is required to notify hikers or bird watchers or really any outdoor recreationists that these traps are present, nor is the trapper required to leave any sort of marking on the traps. And this is for legal trapping. The one that Maggie encountered was probably an illegal trap, not licensed. But we've also identified two other cases of people having their dogs or they themselves caught in the same month, December 2010, while hiking on public lands. And so this is an ongoing problem, and more New Mexicans are encountering traps while out hiking.
So as you say, traps are indiscriminate. They can catch anything from people to dogs to the animals that the trappers are out for. For what purpose are they trapping?
Generally, it's for either sport. It's something they may have grown up doing. It's also to capture fur-bearing animals like bobcats and beaver in order to sell the pelts. We're currently at a very high price for bobcat pelts on fur sale markets, and so we're seeing some trapping because of that. But trapping, even though it's widespread across New Mexico, there really isn't that much of it going on that's licensed. Only 2,200 trap licenses were sold last year by the Game and Fish Department. That's less than 0.1% of the New Mexico's population. And when you compare that to the amount of people who are outside for, wildlife viewing, for hiking, for rock climbing, whatever the outdoor recreation is, it really, dwarfs the amount of people who are doing this for trapping. And
so if you look at the economic benefit to people, there's probably more economic benefit involved with wildlife viewing and all that stuff.
Yes. I mean, in 2004, the New Mexico Department of Game and Fish released its trapping wildlife and tourism statistics. That year, only 767 trappers bought a license license in New Mexico and only generated $671,000. Now, of that same year, the amount of New Mexicans who were active in wildlife viewing was 449,000 and generated 572 times that amount in revenue to the state. That's $384 million.
Right,
and
right.
So it's grossly disproportionate when you consider the amount of harm these traps have potential to cause, you know, really anybody using the wild lands. That includes hikers, that includes bird watchers, that also includes other hunters.
We're talking to Phil Carter with Animal Protection New Mexico and Maggie Craw. Now, what is the politics of all this? I mean, what are people on both sides doing? Is there like a pro-trapping lobby? I think that sort of secretive and mysterious small business task force has something to do mm-hmm. with this whole issue.
Yes. Well, a few months ago, Governor Martinez released a report on the small business task force, which called for, you know, an end to the ban on set by Governor Richardson last year on trapping in the Mexican wolf recovery area, as well as trying to increase the considered trapping opportunities there. So there's definitely, you know, a political force behind some trapping in the state, which, you know, when you compare it to the amount of people who are actually trapping, again, 2,200 is about one-tenth of 1%, even if you discount the amount of out-of-state trappers that amount includes.
Now, is trapping on private land an option for some of these people who, for whatever reason, want to keep on doing their trapping?
Well, yes. I mean, trapping on private land is legal and is sometimes practiced, you know, for sport or for hobby or also, you know.
Is it available to somebody who says, I want to go trap bobcats, where can I go, that's not public land? And let's say you banned this and those 2,200 people wanted somewhere to go. What would they do?
Well, they would probably have to go on private land with an outfitter or buy a license from the private landowner. In that case, which obviously is an option if you are a private landowner to open up your land for trapping, that, of course, you know, drives up the safety risk for you and your pets on your own private land. And so it's questionable if anybody would actually want to do that or not.
So on the other side, who's opposing it? You're Animal Protection New Mexico, but there's a whole coalition of people and organizations.
Well, yes. In late May, we sent a letter to the New Mexico Department of Game and Fish, as well as the New Mexico Game Commission, which sets wildlife management policies. We, being Animal Protection New Mexico, Wild Earth Guardians, Sierra Club, and a number of independent activists on this issue, in order to kind of outline why trapping is cruel and dangerous for wildlife, why it's taking just a huge toll on wildlife that really isn't being reported. During the 2009-2010 trapping season, only 29% of the licensed trappers actually reported to the mandatory harvest survey of New Mexico Department of Game and Fish. That's less than one in three permitted trappers reported their totals. And so
then do they get traps the next year anyway? Or
Presumably, they have gone back and gotten the same amount of traps. Game and Fish Department has not, you know, enforced any sort of limitation on people who don't report as of yet. And so essentially the department has no real sense of what the toll on wildlife is because, you know, they have such incomplete data coming from these mandatory harvest surveys. And so, you know, we all outlined all these points in this letter and the fact that numerous counties and cities have instituted resolutions supporting a ban on public lands trapping within their area. That includes the Santa Fe City Council in late February instituted a resolution, as well as Doñana County, Silver City, and just recently Taos County also instituted a similar resolution.
Now, you've already talked about how traps are indiscriminate and how they're cruel. We don't know what they're doing to ecosystems, or what can you say about the relationship between trapping and harming ecosystems, large predators and whatnot?
Well, earlier in the show, I mentioned that there's two designations of wildlife that is trapped in New Mexico. That's target, the things that are the creatures that are legal, as well as bycatch. Now, trappers are not required to report any sort of bycatch animals, and that includes really anything that isn't a quote-unquote fur bearer, like a bobcat or coyote or beaver. I mean,
so if they trapped a unicorn, that would be bycatch?
That would be bycatch. They are not required to report it. Presumably, they will either use it for meat or just leave it out there. So, yes.
What about wolves? I mean, what about this endangered species that they're trying to put in the wolf recovery area?
Right. I mean, that was the impetus for Governor Richardson instituting the ban on trapping in 2011 for the Mexican wolf recovery area, because, we have identified at least 14 wolves who have been caught in traps and severely injured since 2002, two of which in the Middle Fork pack, the alphas, are both, three-legged wolves because of traps. They had to have legs amputated. And so this species, this endangered species, is already having a very difficult time reestablishing in the wild. We're now at only 50 wild wolves in New Mexico and Arizona, had an additional strain with trapping out there. And that is why, the New Mexico Game Commission instituted this trapping ban last October.
And so what are you asking people to do who are concerned about this?
Well, we would like anybody who's concerned about this to write in to the New Mexico Game Commission, to the New Mexico Department of Game and Fish, and also to Governor Martinez. If they don't live in any of the counties or cities that I outlined that already have a resolution, please write in to their county commissioners or city commissioners saying they would also like to see a resolution supporting this or an outright ban within their city or county limits on this as a public safety risk as well as ecological risk. Also contact Animal Protection in New Mexico if you or somebody you know has had an experience with a trap. We're compiling the total numbers of people who have been affected, either they or their dogs or pets have been affected by this. And so contact me. And coming up on June 9th, the Game Commission will be discussing the trap ban in Mexican wolf country. So please write to your game commissioners supporting that, because these wolves need a leg up, no pun intended.
And all of these numbers and emails and addresses and phone numbers, all that can be found on
APNM's website.
And Animal Protection New Mexico, which is APNM.org.
Correct.
Phil, do you have any sense of how New Mexicans overall feel about this issue of trapping?
Well, back in 2005, Research and Polling Incorporated out of Albuquerque did a poll of New Mexicans and found that 63% of New Mexicans, which is across the board, all different races and sexes and hobbyists, support 63% support prohibiting trapping on public lands. And that includes 52% hunters, 59% fishermen. So even the sportsmen are really looking to see this, restricted or prohibited.
Right. Interesting. It's a very funny thing. Years and years ago, I went to Kodiak, Alaska, and visited a friend there. And one day we went hunting, and I'd never been hunting before, and the experience of hunting was so different than the experience of hiking. And I felt viscerally how incompatible those two things were, and I was thinking about that when you were talking. When you go out in hiking in the Santa Fe National Forest, you really don't want to be thinking about traps or people who are hunting for animals in one way or another, and I don't know whether they have tried to separate those things at all. I mean, whether there are some areas that would be designated for one thing or another thing. I mean, right now it's all lumped together.
Yes, it is all lumped together. And as I said earlier, the trappers nor the agencies are required to notify hikers or hunters or anybody if there are traps in the area.
And you're right. Once it happens, you're impacted. As I said, my dog was lucky. She got off relatively unscathed. But I'm changed forever. I will not go hiking in the forest alone. And I will probably never go hiking or be in the forest with the same level of comfort that I once had.
Right.
I'm on guard now.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. So are you, Maggie, activating your friends and your own network in this particular issue?
I'm talking to people, and I'm starting to collect petitions. And basically, For the most part, I've just been making myself available to tell my story at commission meetings or when we're given the opportunity that you're providing us today.
Phil Carter is the Wildlife Campaign Manager with Animal Protection New Mexico, and Maggie Craw is a concerned citizen, mother of Lulu the dog, who is walking just fine now, I take it.
Yes, thank you.
And once more, for more information, you can write to, or you can go to the website, apnm.org. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Jan Willem Janssens. He is director of the Earthworks Institute here in Santa Fe. Peter Arnold joins us by phone. He's director of the Arid Lands Institute at Woodbury University in Burbank, California. And Esteban Arellano is from the Embudo Valley Acequia Association. Welcome, gentlemen, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Schneider.
And we are here because coming up this weekend, starting on Friday, is an event called, it's the fourth annual Celebrando las Acequias, Water and Resilience, in Dixon, New Mexico. Let's start talking about acequias. Esteban, you are from, I guess, a family, a tradition that has been farming using acequia water for many generations.
Well, my family goes back to 1725 in Embudo. So there's been acequias in the what it used to be the Embudo land grants in 1725. There's 10 acequias that draw water from the Rio Embudo, and there's about four others that draw water from the Rio Grande in the community of Rinconada and along the Rio Grande before you get to like to the Embudo station. But most of the ones we're concerned with are the smaller acequias that get the water from the Rio Embudo. There's five on each side of the river.
Now, how are these acequias being used right now, and how were they used in the past?
Well, traditionally they have been used for agriculture in the past. Most of the crops that were grown were corn, chili, and wheat. Now there's a lot of alfalfa, there's also orchards, plus a lot of vegetable gardens. People grow fruits and vegetables for the Santa Fe market, the Los Alamos market, Española, Taos market. We have about 700 acres under irrigation. Not all of them are under cultivation at this point.
And how are the acequias doing? Do they have the water that they need?
Well, right now we've had enough water. I don't know if it continues as dry as it has been. I think we're going to run out of water, and when that happens is that people have to share the water. They divide the water. The four upper acequias get the water for 3 days, then the four lower acequias get it for 4 days, and then ours and another one, we're not part of that sharing agreement, because there's always plenty of water, though we're the last ones because of springs that come up on the river.
So are you farming yourself?
Yeah.
What do you farm?
Well, we usually have a small garden of different vegetables, chili, corn, squash, tomatoes.
Are most of the people who are working with these acequias that you're talking about bringing food to the farmers market?
Not everybody, but a lot of them are just growing food for the family use. But there's quite a few that participate in all of the markets. Plus, there's a local market also in Dixon.
Right.
That's starting this coming Wednesday. So a lot of the people that don't grow a lot, that don't have enough to come to Santa Fe, they participate in the local market there in Dixon or in Española.
Jan Willem, tell us about your relationship to this whole question of acequias.
Yeah, Mary Charlotte, several years ago, we got involved with the community when staff members identified that there was a watershed plan just completed, actually, and that some people were interested in working with us based on the work that we've been doing here in the Galisteo Basin south of Santa Fe to see if we could do something similar for the Embudo Valley, soil stabilization, erosion control, flood control, revegetation of eroded slopes, all to the benefit of the acequias and the cleanup of the river, which now sees a lot of sediment. So the acequias annually are sedimented, which costs a lot of money to the acequia associations, and the river is so filled with sediment.
Because of erosion?
Because of erosion, and there's lots of arroyos that come from the escarpment and the valleys around the bigger Embudo Valley that dump all that sediment through the arroyos in the river, in the Embudo River, to the point that the river is in some places just choked with sediment, and that the traditional trout fishery that used to be there 30, 40 years ago is no longer very viable. And the state has identified it as one of the priority rivers that really needs treatment.
So the cause of all of this sediment coming in, clarify that a little bit.
Oh, well, it is a long history of, I think, first of all, a very erosive geological landscape. It's all sandstone material that was uplifted millions of years ago and is now very steep and exposed. And second, that in the last 200 years, sheep grazing, logging, and all forms of land management, grazing included, have led to so much denudation of slopes that that material is now getting at a critical point of massively coming down.
So when you take the plants off it, nothing holds the dirt in place. It rushes into the water.
Yeah, basically a healthy landscape is based on a layer of soil with organic material and roots and plants that hold it all together. In many uplands around Dixon, that sponge, that soil is gone. And so the infiltration of water is very poor, so that water just runs down the steep slopes, sometimes on bedrock, taking everything with it in its path. It ends up in these big washes of arroyos of sediment that push it all down to the river. We've measured that there is just enormous, I don't have the numbers right now, but thousands and thousands, tens of thousands of tons of sediment coming down every year.
Good heavens.
Yes.
And so what is to be done about that? What are you doing? What are others doing?
Okay. So already 15, 20 years ago, the state had identified that it was a high priority area to capture that sediment. For years, there have been all kind of plans and discussions evolved to see what to do. I think the acequia associations must have been working on it very hard too, Esteban. And so, but since that plan of 2007, we're now looking at, we're honing in on specific arroyos to set up pilot projects for erosion control to show the community how we can work together with the county, with the BLM, who owns actually most of the land directly around Dixon, and the experts who know low-impact, relatively affordable erosion control techniques to make that water slow down, make it infiltrate, slow the sediment down, so that the impacts on the river and the acequias is less. And that is kind of a short-term project, and then in the longer term, we're planning to get a final research program together with monitoring data that will allow us to get larger federal dollars for much larger scale solutions, because we have just, well, I think everybody who has been involved there knows that it will cost millions of dollars to really stabilize the soil to the point that the river gets healthier and the acequias can survive.
Now, Peter Arnold, joining us by phone, you're with the Arid Lands Institute, and you are in California, but also addressing the problem of water and lack of water in the West, particularly in the face of climate change. Tell us about what you're doing and in its relationship to New Mexico.
Fantastic. You know, water scarcity is both the history and also the future of the American West, and we are looking at that very, very critically. Our research institute is unique in a couple ways, and one of them is that it focuses on critical discourse and design innovation as a means for envisioning alternative futures. And it's also unique in that it focuses tightly on the American West. Design, we would argue, plays a very vital role in our understanding of landscape and also our understanding of resource use. In an urbanized setting, very difficult to see where your water comes from. It's also very difficult to see all the embodied energy that goes into bringing that water, treating it, distributing it, refiltering it, and then rushing and then pushing it back out to the sea. The interaction and the connection between water energy use and climate change, these things are all very closely related. And obviously, the more water we need in our current infrastructural setup, the more energy it takes to bring that water to urbanized areas. And currently, the production of that energy is very carbon intensive. So these two things actually act as a feedback loop. Why would we be interested in the acequias in northern New Mexico? That's 900 miles away, for the simple fact that the acequia culture is something that is highly resilient. It's very visible, and it's in our estimation, and hopefully the estimation of many others, almost a near perfect model of resource management for the American West. It has long-term historical roots. Those historical roots tend to touch the students that we serve. We're a Hispanic-serving institute, or university, pardon me. And many of our students are also come from the Middle East, which there's a direct connection there to the ancestral roots of the acequia culture from the Middle East.
So the acequias in the Middle East are the models for the acequias in places like New Mexico?
Well, I think Estevan could probably answer that better, but in a way, the acequia technology has migrated from the Middle East through the Iberian Peninsula to the Americas and up to Mesoamerica and up into the West. And it's every point of this migration, it's changed, and that's something of both celebration. And of tremendous interest with our institute, and that's one of the reasons why the Celebrando has been created, is to foreground that uniqueness.
Let's talk about not only acequias as sources for water for gardens and plants and so on, but also as a cultural phenomenon. How does do the acequias link communities and provide a cultural base?
I think that the acequias, when we're talking about acequias, we should not just focus on the canal, which is the actual infrastructure that carries the water. But the acequia, like say the acequia culture, permeates throughout the whole life of people that live in arid lands. There has to be a way of getting water. And the acequias is a way of getting the water from tributaries or rivers like the Rio Grande into communities. And for that reason, a lot of the communities in northern New Mexico exist because of the acequias. If there weren't any acequias, there wouldn't be any of those communities. So these communities, like Peter said, the word acequia, I traced it back to Yemen. And then it came up with what's known as a acequia trail through North Africa and to the Iberian Peninsula, eventually to Mesoamerica and up the Camino Real de Tierra Adentro, which is also known as a Camino de Agua, or the water road, all the way from Mexico City to San Juan or Oqueowingue. So we have that long history. And it's not that the Native Americans didn't have any irrigation. They had irrigation before, but not as widespread as when the acequias were introduced. Every village has, like in the Embudo Valley, it's a small valley, and it has about 14 total acequias. And everyone is unique in its own way, because they all each have a commission of three members, the president, the secretary, and the treasurer. And then they in turn either elect or select a mayordomo, which is a person that oversees the daily function of the acequia. So everything is falls usually under the mayordomo. If there's a flood, he has to be there 24/7 so that he can open the desagües to let the water back into the rivers, so that you don't end up silting all the the acequia because of all the silt coming in through the arroyos, as Jan was saying.
I think the way that acequia life is structured kind of underlines one of the differences between northern New Mexico Spanish culture and Anglo-American culture, just the way the authority and labor is, I think, more communal or community-oriented in acequia culture.
Well, an acequia is a really like a worker-owned co-op. It's owned by all the what are known as the parciantes. The parciantes are the water rights owners. And the word parciante comes from a parcela or a parcel of land. So everybody that owns a parcel of land that falls under the acequia is a member of the acequia. And but in order for him to use the water, for that person to use the water, they have to be paid up the dues. They have to be caught up with the dues. If not, the mayordomo will tell you, well, I'm sorry, you can't irrigate until you pay up. So there's a way of always, I think it's the most democratic type of institution we have, because it's very few people that are in charge, you know. Like in our acequia, there's only 37 parciantes. The biggest acequia there in the Dixon area has about 110 parciantes. And then there's one that only has about 8. But every acequia has to have the three commissioners and the mayordomo, which in a way is kind of like the CEO, you know, is in charge of the overall operation of the acequia on a daily basis.
Right. Now, part of the challenge that all of northern New Mexico is facing in terms of water is invasive species. How is that being addressed?
Actually, at this point, we don't see that as a major problem. At this point, we would be happy to see any vegetation to grow even there.
Oh, okay.
And,
so better a Siberian elm than bare eroded land.
Absolutely, Mayor Charlotte.
Interesting.
I'd like to hear Stefan's point of view about that too. But currently, we don't see in these arroyos many invasive species. And where there are some elms, at this point, I would say, oh, please leave them there, because we need vegetation to cover the soil at this point. We need the soil to even actually be more ready to absorb that water, hold it back on the slopes, on the banks, rather than end up rushing down these arroyos, filling the acequias full with sediment and dumping it like big floods into the river.
What's your point of view on that,
well,
Esteban?
My point of view is a little bit different, I guess, because I have to deal with them on a daily basis. They're taking over a lot of the agricultural land.
The elms are?
The elms are sprouting like alfalfa. In my place, just from 1 year to the next, they're already about 6-7 feet tall. And then the root probably is 10 feet deep. So that's the thing, you know, is that in our acequia, we cut down all the elms on the banks of the acequia, because what was happening is that the seeds were falling into the acequia. Then when I opened my head gate to irrigate my land, all that seed ends up in my property, and they're sprouting like wildfire everywhere, you know. So people are spending a lot of money now to remove the elms.
They're so hard to get rid of.
I can see your point in terms of the arroyos. You know, maybe in the arroyos in some places they do indeed help to retain the soil. But once they get into the agricultural land, they're evil.
No, I totally agree with you, Esteban. I think I was thinking more about the slopes and the arroyos, but once they get onto the acequia system and the fields, yeah, you need to get rid of them to maintain and increase the productivity of the land. Absolutely.
So we're talking about an event that's actually coming up this coming weekend, June 10th through 12th, Friday through Sunday. It's called the 4th Annual Celebrando las Acequias, Water and Resilience. It's sponsored by the Arid Lands Institute. Now, what is going to be happening? Who wants to take that? Peter? Or?
Sure. Well, Esteban Arellano is the event coordinator, and he and I have been very involved in designing a 3-day event. starts off with a kind of global overview of historic and prehistoric irrigation practices by Robert Hunt, who's a coming from Brandeis University. There's a fabulous photography exhibit by Sharon Stewart. She also is having a show at Santa Fe. Estevan, I'm sorry, I blanked on the name. Santa Fe Museum of Art, I think. And then Ron Real will talk about the use of infrastructure as a way of making space and place. On Saturday, there's a emphasis on looking at hydrologic management of the acequias. Food is a really important component of that. Traditions through language and land art is introduced in the afternoon by Catherine Harris. There's a panel discussion looking at the state of agriculture in northern New Mexico. One of the highlights is the dinner and recognition that Estevan can speak to in the evening. And then Sunday is a much more of a kind of technically focused day in which Jan Willem will present his work. We have an engineer from Santa Fe Biohabitats and the noted landscape teacher Brad Lancaster will be doing a presentation and also a workshop in on a problematic site in Dixon.
So this is something for everybody, I think. I mean, this is the idea is that not only people who are really working in this area, but anybody can come and learn about water, learn about acequias.
I think that we started 4 years ago, and the goal was to make the people aware of the value of the acequias, because I think a lot of people are, there's a lot of apathy today, you know, that people, because they work out of the village, they're not taking really the good care of the acequias as they should. And this was started to, so that we could bring that awareness not only to the local people, but also to show that relation between rural areas and urban areas, you know, that if you have a healthy rural area that's producing food, then those people can come and sell at the local markets, or people from Santa Fe or Albuquerque can go and buy their apples at the Fred Martinez orchard there, which is the biggest orchard in the valley, you know. So it's a kind of also promoting economic development. That's one of the goals also, you know, to promote. But you have to have healthy acequias. The acequias are all silted up with sand from a flood, and we can't irrigate what we planted, then everybody loses.
Right.
So we need to make the people aware how important these fragile systems are. You know, it's the whole acequia landscape is one of the most fragile because it's in a desert type of a landscape.
Now, one of the issues that I think is very important to discuss is what we call food security. There are a lot of reasons to worry. One of them is the loss of topsoil to development, erosion, misuse of land, industrial agriculture, things like that. Another problem is climate change and the projected decrease of water supply, and just those two things alone. I mean, there's a lot of food that comes into New Mexico from out of state, and when you think about the possibility of producing food and eating locally, that's no small task if you just think about the quantity of food that is required to feed, well, statewide 2 million people.
Yeah, and I think that leads to directly to the theme of this celebration as well, because I think it is clear to all of us organizers that local food production is really important to make people aware first where their food comes from, like Peter said, in the corollary towards water, and the second piece is if you start or if you continue and support the local food production, you're potentially more resilient than if you're dependent on food that comes 1,500 or 2,000 miles away. And on top of all that, it makes people aware of how important soil and local water in a desert is, so that actually, and that you are not responsible for that as just a single farmer, but you're responsible for that as a community, and not just the community where the food is grown, but also the wider community, so that if you're living in the Santa Fe area, that you realize, like, hey, buying food from Dixon helps in a regional sense support a local economy, supports local people with their knowledge to support, to develop and sustain local food systems with that local economy. It also sustains the local knowledge of how aware we all need to be around other issues of land use, forestry, recreation, that all have an impact on the soil and the water conservation in the uplands, where actually the greatest sponges of that water that eventually flows down and is then, through this very sophisticated, although very old and traditional system, but still very sophisticated in its decision-making process, in its technical and engineering process, applied to the local food production and makes food production possible at an intensity and a productivity that otherwise the land would not be able to support.
So this is the fourth annual Celebrando las Acequias. In the 4 years, Esteban Arellano, that you've been doing this, what kind of changes have you seen in people's awareness about the acequias, about eating local food, and so on?
I think it's, well, you know, it takes a lot of time for people to really start changing their way of doing things. But what I've noticed is in some of the acequias, and it's probably more based on the work that we have done in our own acequia, Junta y Cienega, is that they're seeing it as a model. We know we lowered all the banks. They were very high. When you were cleaning, you were throwing the dirt up and it would come back into your face. And so we started leveling the banks. We started cutting all the invasive species and make it easier for the mayordomo to be able to walk and to patrol the system, which he has to. And now the other people are in the other acequias are saying, well, maybe this is what we should do in ours. So they're taking kind of a cue from us, you know, and starting to look at their own acequia and knowing that some of them are in really bad condition. So I think it's been kind of a model what we're doing. And then when they also hear people from other perspectives that are working with acequias, I think that has also impacted not only our community, but communities throughout northern New Mexico. Because we're getting people from Mora, we're getting people from Taos, we're getting people from Santa Fe. And the people from Santa Fe that go say, well, you know, too bad that in Santa Fe we only have one acequia now. Whereas at one time there used to be 37 acequias. Used to be a lot of... There used to be a lot of terracing here. Now it's all covered with asphalt. And I think people are starting to realize that if we're not careful, a lot of the villages can become little Santa Fe's, you know.
Right, exactly. So, Celebrando las Acequias, Water and Resilience, this Friday through Sunday, June 10th through 12th at the Embudo Mission Building in Dixon, New Mexico. It's a free event. It's open to anybody. And for more information, what should people do?
They can call. Arid land. I'm sorry. you can call Esteban Arellano at or you could go to aridlands.woodbury.edu, and I'll let I'll
put that on my website, santafe.radiocafe.org, so if anyone's listening to it, they can just go right to it and click on that. But aridlands at .woodbury.edu, or they can call. Do you want to, Esteban, give your telephone?
Yeah, 505-579-4027.
Well, I want to thank you all very much for being here. Jan Willem Janssens of Earthworks Institute, Peter Arnold of the Arid Lands Institute at Woodbury University, and Esteban Arellano from the Embudo Valley Acequia Association. And we will see you at Celebrando las Acequias.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org. Thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. And my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.